Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the continuation of our new series, Rabbis on the Run. Rabbis on the Run is an extension of a series we've been doing for many years now called The People of the Book, Tuesday nights, in which we examine different major personalities in Jewish history and Jewish scholarship. It's enabling us to blend Jewish history together with the Torah learning, Jewish scholarship. And each year, each season, we try to think of another theme, another way to communicate another unit in this series called The People of the Book. We are the people of the book. You could find online on YU Torah and elsewhere the series classes. We're grateful to Rabbi Maskos, Rabbi Kasorla, and those who have taught. This year, our theme is Rabbis on the Run, which are the people who compose tremendous scholarship even while fleeing persecution and oppression. It's an astounding, astounding thing. I mentioned this morning in the Parsha class that we have the luxury, at least here in Boca Raton, you sit under a palm tree. Today wasn't so nice, Taka, but you sit under a palm tree, beautiful weather, a sip of pina colada, you got a laptop, high-speed internet, you can Google, you've got the Bar Ilan, you've got the Otzar HaChachma, and yet we can't have an original thought. And we have an incredible, incredible, rich history of great rabbis, great leaders, who fleeing for their lives, trying to secure their families, who were on the run, didn't have books, no printing press, didn't have a computer, couldn't save drafts of what they were writing, and we have been gifted the tremendous Torah that we have. So that is our series, Rabbis on the Run, and I want to express our collective gratitude to our dear friends, Lenny and Chani Grunstein, who sponsored this series in memory of their fathers, Morris Grunstein and Mr. Aaron Tambor. So thank you for your generosity, and thank you for enabling all of this learning. I have the privilege this evening, first of all, I'm shocked anybody's here. None of you must watch the news, but Baruch Hashem, better that way. I'm glad that, nothing to be afraid of. I'm glad that you're here, and those who are joining us online as well. It's wonderful to be together. And we're going to examine the life and the legacy, the story of the Rosh, Rabbeinu Asher. Any student of Talmud knows you cannot learn Gemara on the page itself. You have Rashi on the inside column of Shlomo Yitzchaki. You have on the outside column Rashi's descendants, the school of the Tosafists, Franco-German Tosafos. And in the back of the Gemara, you have the Rosh, Rabbeinu Asher. He is a staple in Gemara. And not only is he a staple in Gemara, he is a foundation and a pillar, a staple in the halachic process. The Mechaber, Rabbi Yosef Karo, in his introduction to the Shulchan Aruch, writes, "I'm not a rabbi being persecuted or on the run, but I am trying to balance a lot, so I did not get a source sheet done for you, but I'm happy to share so many of these sources." Rav Yosef Karo, in his introduction to the Shulchan Aruch, Rav Yosef Karo, of 1488 to 1575, the great Mechaber, who we'll talk about, writes a commentary, the Beis Yosef, on the Tur, which was authored by the son of the Rosh. The Tur, the Beis Yosef, was his extrapolation of halacha. And then he said, it's so long, it's so lengthy, no one's going to read it, so no one's going to learn it. He says, I'm going to write a succinct summary of the Beis Yosef, and he publishes the Shulchan Aruch. This is worthy of study in its own right. We probably have previously in People of the Book. And Rav Yosef Karo, in his introduction to the Shulchan Aruch, writes, I have succinctly captured everything that was in my Beis Yosef, and I did it in such a manner that every Jew can learn the entire Shulchan Aruch at least once a year. At least once a year. That was the expectation. Now, the truth is the Shulchan Aruch is not short. It's not as long as we perceive it, because we publish only a paragraph or two on every page because of the rich commentary, the super commentary that surrounds it. But Rav Yosef Karo, who in the 16th century becomes the halachic standard, in fact, he, Shulchan Aruch, he sets the table upon which the Ramar of Moshe Isserles puts his mappa, his tablecloth, on that table, representing Ashkenazic tradition, Ashkenazic Jewry. Rav Yosef Karo is living in Spain, then in Israel, and the Ramaz living in Krakow, Poland. So Rav Yosef Karo, who is the, as I said, the standard of halacha, the Ramaz disagrees, but only occasionally, Ashkenazim too, we too are bound by the Shulchan Aruch. In his introduction, he says, La'ala b'dayte sha'achar kol advarim efsok halacha v'achriya bein hasvaros. After my investigation, after my analysis, I'm going to come to a conclusion, ki zeu atachlis lios lanu Torah achas u'mishpat echad, because that's the goal. We don't have, while we have debate, and while we have rich debate, in an analysis, we have to come to a conclusion. We should have some level of a unified practice. We shouldn't look like we have multiple Torahs. We should look like we have one unified system of Torah. So how is he going to do it? V'ra'isi she'embanu lomar she'nachriya din ben aposkim, v'tainus arayos tamluduyos. He says, well, if I include everybody, how am I going to get there? Tosfos, Ramban, the Rajba, the Ran, there are endless, not endless, but there are many, many Rishonim. So fast forward, he says, V'lachein iskamti b'dayt k'li yoshloshes amudei orah, asher habayis beis Yisrael nishan aleihem. I have three pillars upon which the Jewish home, the Jewish house will rest. And they are Harif, Rabbeinu Alphas, the Rambam, Maimonides, and the third pillar is Harosh. Amarti alibi shevamokum sheshnai meim askim ladas achas nifsak halacha kemosam. Shulchan Aruch takes the principle of acharei rabim lahatos. We follow the majority. He takes it quite literally. So he says these are the three who get a vote, and then he chose an odd number intentionally by design, and he says two of the three, that's who we're going with. And that is how he comes to his halachic conclusions in the Shulchan Aruch. So alongside these giants, the Rif and the Rambam, is none other than our personality, whom we'll study this evening, the Rosh, Rabbeinu Asher. Different than the Rif and the Rambam, the Rosh is unusual, though not unique. And the reason he's included in our series, Rabbis on the Run, is because the Rosh has the distinction of having been a gadol, a great posek, a great Talmudist, a great community leader, a Rav, a Dayan, a Rosh Hashiva, not only in the world of Ashkenaz in which he's born, in France and Germany, but he emigrates to Spain, where he again emerges as a leader who is beloved, admired, a leader who is a halachic authority, and so in many ways, he blends those two worlds, and that is our study for tonight. He was not born the Rosh. That was not the name on his birth certificate. It was not the name that was given to him at his bris. It is not how his mother called him when it was time for dinner. His name was Asher. We call him Rabbeinu Asher ben Yechiel. He was born in the year 1250, and he died in the year 1327. He was born in Cologne in the Holy Roman Empire, and he died in Spain in Toledo. It was pointed out to me, it's not Toledo. Toledo is in Ohio. Toledo is in Spain. So as I said, he migrated from Germany, the Holy Roman Empire, to Toledo, to Spain. His father, Yechiel, was a Talmud scholar himself, as we often find. He had a mind, he had an upbringing. I mentioned last night in introducing Rav David Yosef, the son of Rav Avadi Yosef, Tzadik ben Tzadik, that we have a tradition of how significant it is to be a Tzadik ben Tzadik is even greater than a Tzadik ben Russia. When you are the child of a wicked person, so it's true you didn't have a role model to learn from, but you also were motivated to be nothing like the person you came from. Hopefully one was turned off by that corruption they saw. But a Tzadik ben Tzadik, this was somewhat courageous of me to introduce him this way, but I said a Tzadik ben Tzadik, you grew up in the home of Rav Avadi Yosef, you say, why bother? Why bother trying to compete? Why bother? I'll never measure up. Why bother? And to be a Tzadik ben Tzadik, to author a 19-volume set on halacha, to be a Tzadik ben Tzadik, that is righteous. So we find that with many of our scholars that it was true with the Rosh, with Rabbeinu Asher. Rabbeinu Asher is the son of Yechiel, Rabbeinu Yechiel. He descends as well from the Ra'avan, Rabbi Elazar ben Nasan. He had eight sons. We know of two of them, their names, because one of them is prominent in his own right, Rabbi Yaakov. Rabbi Yaakov ben Rabbi Asher is the author of the Tur, the Arba Turim, what we know as the four orders of Shulchan Aruch, of Aruch Chaim, Yoredeya, Evin Ezer, and Choshen Mishpat. Aruch Chaim is daily living, and Yoredeya, Kibbut Aveim, Kashrus, Avelos, Nida, and the like. Choshen Mishpat, financial, interpersonal business. And Evin Ezer, status, marriage, divorce. These, for halacha, for Jewish law, to be arranged and organized into those four categories, into those four orders, was introduced by the Rosh's son, Rabbeinu Yaakov. He references, Rabbeinu Yaakov, that he had a brother, and we have works of his brother. His brother was Rabbi Yehuda. So the Rosh had eight sons, two of them we know their names, Rabbi Yaakov and Rabbi Yehuda. The Rosh had at least two daughters as well. We know that his sons only marry within the family, even when they emigrate to Spain. They remain and they continue part of that Ashkenazic tradition. His two daughters marry Spaniards. His two daughters marry within the Spanish community. And that is a great, I think, statement of confidence, immersion, integration, that the Rosh is willing to allow such an intermarriage between an Ashkenazi and a Sephardi, a mixed marriage, an intermarriage, and the Rosh allows that with his daughters. The Rosh had a very, very prominent Rebbe. The Rush learned in the Beis Medrash. The Rush was a student of, anyone know? The Maharam Meirutenberg. Maharam Meirutenberg lived from 1215 to 1293. The Maharam Meirutenberg is the continuation of a chain of great scholarship. Anyone know who the Rebbe of the Maharam Meirutenberg was? Reb Meir of Rothenburg. Who his Rebbe was? None other than the Or Zarua and Rav Yechiel of Paris, one of the great Balei HaTosfos. So the Maharam Meirutenberg, Rav Meir of Rothenburg, was considered the last of the Balei HaTosfos. The Talmud is divided. Again, we discussed this in one of the early units of people of the book. We have the Mishnah, Tanaitic literature. We have the Talmud, Amoritic literature. The Brises, the Tosefta's are still part of the Tanaitic literature. Then we have the period of the Gaonim, following the period of the Gaonim, which, by the way, just as an aside, the Rush ascribed no greater status to the Gaonim over the Rishonim. The Rush writes in a tshuva that he doesn't give greater authority to the Gaonim over the Rishonim, although other halachists disagree. So we have the Tanaim, the Amoraim, the Savoraim. We have the period of the Gaonim. And then we have the Rishonim, the medieval early commentaries. And then we have the Achronim, and we have the early Achronim, and we are still in the period of the later Achronim. I'm sure the even later Achronim will consider us, will consider us the middle, still part of the early Achronim, but we are in the period of the Achronim. So the Balei HaTosfos, Rashi, his descendants, Rashi's own sons-in-law, grandsons, are part of the school known as the Balei HaTosfos. They live in France and Germany, medieval times. They suffer from the Crusades. And the last of the Balei HaTosfos, considered to be the final authority of the Balei HaTosfos, is Rav Meir of Rothenburg, the Maharam of Rothenburg, student of the Or Zarur, Rav Yechiel of Paris. He was present in 1242. We're all familiar with the story. We read it on Tisha B'Av morning. The Kina that he wrote, the Maharam Meirutenberg authored the Kina of Shali Srufa Ba'esh. He was present when there was the burning of countless wagons of the Talmud in Paris in 1242, prior to the printing press. We can imagine how devastated we would be if someone collected all the volumes of our sacred library, of our Beis Medrash, and publicly burned them. The statement it would make, how devastated we would be lost, and all you'd have to do is go on Amazon and press print, and they'd print another set for you, and the library would be full again, and it would be devastating. Imagine no printing press. Imagine the painstaking labor of hand copying, of manuscripts, of limited editions, and the burning of these wagon loads, what that represented. Maharam Meirutenberg understood that as punishment for their having burned the books of the Rambam. We all know from the Kina of Tisha B'Av morning, Shali Srufa Ba'esh, that is the Maharam Meirutenberg, the last of the Balei HaTosfos. But the first of the Balei HaTosfos who really published elaborately his tshuvas, his responsa. The Maharam Meirutenberg is considered to be the halachic authority in Germany and the surrounding areas, the Holy Roman Empire, what it was considered then, how it was labeled or known then, France and Germany, among the Balei HaTosfos. So this Maharam Meirutenberg, who I just described, is the Rebbe of the Rush. It's in his Beis Medrash that Rabbeinu Asher learns, that he grows up, that he studies, and that he gains a methodology, an approach to learning, an approach to halacha, and an approach to life. 1286. We go to 1286, King Rudolf I. King Rudolf I institutes a new persecution against the Jews. He increases the taxation, and he ups the physical persecution. As we all know, in antiquity, through the Middle Ages, and until today, the non-Jewish host nations that have Jews, they have this vicious cycle of being grateful for our presence because it helps the economy. We do a good job stimulating the economy and conducting the economy and protecting the economy. And then when they're comfortable in the economy, they remember they hate the Jews, want to persecute, oppress, want to exterminate, or want to send us out of their land. So this was one of those periods of persecution, a rise of anti-Semitism, 1286. We're talking about the end of the period of the Crusades, after the Crusades. And a new period, King Rudolf I, the Maharam, as I said, is the biggest rabbi in Ashkenaz, in the Rhineland at the time, and he's recognized as such with that distinction. Now, it's unclear exactly why King Rudolf went after the Maharam, but the Maharam, according to many traditions, wanted to go to Eretz Yisrael. He wanted to move to the land of Israel, and the king was concerned that if he would leave, he would take the Jews with him. And what would happen if he took the Jews with him? You don't have a lot of people to tax. You got a nice return on the taxes. You could squeeze the Jew in particular with very little consequence. So if his people would follow, and the Jewish population would diminish, there'd be fewer to tax, and that would hurt the economy and hurt the king's status. And so the Maharam was arrested. He had left Germany at 70 years old, but he was followed. He was arrested by the Duke of Lombardy in Italy in 1286, and he was imprisoned, the Maharam, in a prison in Ansisheim prison in Alsace, France, in that year in 1286. We know the story from several sources, including halachic sources, because there is a halachic discussion that revolves around this capture of the Maharam. I know our topic is the Rosh, not the Maharam Meirutenberg, but understanding this particular episode and story of the Maharam Meirutenberg sets the stage for why the Rosh ultimately emigrates, why he feels he needs to flee. So the Mishnah in Gittin tells us that while releasing a captive, while redeeming somebody who's been taken captive, is among the greatest mitzvos, releasing somebody who's captive, which in our day, thank God, we don't have, although we still do. We have two bodies that are being held by Hamas still in Gaza, Hadar Golden and others, and we should not rest until we get them back. And there are several campaigns still underway. We interviewed his mother, Leah Golden, behind the beamer, and she talked about the efforts we could still be exerting. It still remains a great mitzvah, and we should be devoted. In halacha, there is an analysis and a hierarchy, in fact, of even selling sacred objects in order to have the money to redeem someone. It's considered to be such a great mitzvah. Helping a woman who's an aguna is redeeming somebody who's captive. We have modern applications, sadly still, of this great mitzvah. So the Mishnah in Gittin qualifies and says that while it's considered to be, if we're going to rank mitzvahs, we're not usually in that practice. In fact, we're encouraged the opposite, to not see them as different rank. But this is considered high up, redeeming a captive. But the Mishnah says, do not spend more than the value of the life to redeem them. Why? Because if an enemy captures, and we're willing to overpay, so to say, to get them back, what will we do? We incentivize the enemy to continue to take captives, to take prisoners. Now, this has become a popular halachic discussion when Gilad Shalit was captured and others, prisoner exchange. What are we willing to do? What price are we willing to pay in order to get people home? It's a different conversation for the bodies, though an important conversation than it was for living soldiers who were taken captive. So the Gemara says that a Talmud Chacham might be different. To redeem a community leader, a Talmud Chacham, you might be entitled to pay even more than the value of their life, an even greater ransom. So the Rosh Rabbeinu Asher, his Rebbe, the Maharam Meirutenberg, the great last of the Balei HaTosos, the undisputed leader of Posek of Ashkenaz, of the Rhineland and beyond, is held in prison for 7 years. And the Rosh leads the charge, Rabbeinu Asher leads the charge to put together significant funds in order to pay a ransom for his release. Only one problem. The Maharam Meirutenberg won't hear of it. He says, absolutely not. I'm staying in prison. You cannot overpay in order to get my release, because if you do, you will incentivize and motivate the enemy to simply imprison more and more people. Fast forward, by the way, this discussion, Rabbeinu Asher wanting to overpay to get his Rebbe out of jail, and his Rebbe objecting and protesting and saying, you cannot do that. In Black September, I don't remember what year it was, 1970, Black September 1970, a plane to Israel is hijacked and rerouted to Jordan. On that plane is our own Roni Rab and his family and our community. And on that plane is none other than the great Rosh Yeshiva of Chaim Berlin, Rav Yitzchak Kuttner Zatzal. Rav Kuttner is on the plane, and a group of Talmidim from Chaim Berlin, a group of great rabbinic leaders, say there's an exception that you're allowed to overpay in order to release a great Talmud Chacham, a Rosh Yeshiva, a Gadol Hador. And who objects and says no? Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky. Rosh Yeshiva of Torah Vidas, Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, the Emes Yaakov, says no. Why? Because he says, when are you allowed to overpay? In times of peace. But in times of war, you cannot embolden the enemy by overpaying. And he objects that they should not gather extra money in order to pay for the release of Rav Kuttner. Ultimately, the prisoners on the plane altogether are released. Rav Kuttner comes home, and I wonder what the next meeting of the Moetzes is like of Rav Kuttner and Rav Yaakov. I wonder what that conversation was like. I don't know. I'm sure it was L'shem Shemayim, and both sides I hope, recognized that. So the Maharami Rittenberg resists, he hesitates, and he says to Rabbeinu Asher, the Rush, his Talmud, absolutely not, I object. He's in jail for 7 more years. He dies in prison. He dies in prison in 1293, and his body is held until 1306, for another 13, 14 years, until finally a pious Jew pays in order to redeem and get the release of the body of the Maharami Rutenberg, and he is buried. The story is told, this analysis is done. Rav Shlomo Luria, the great Maharshal, writes in his Tshuvas Maharshal, Shamati Maharami Rutenberg, Zichron Levroch, Shayatofus, B'migdol, Agazim Kamashanim, that he was in prison, Vasar Tovam and Akilos Sach Gadol, and they demanded an enormous ransom, Vakilos Hayurotzin Liftoso, and the community wanted, Velohiniach, he wouldn't allow, he said, you can't, Yosim Mechde Demeim, Vitama Ani, and I wonder, how could that be, Meachash Shayatamid Kachom Muflog, Veloi Kamosa, Bedoro, Betorah, Vachasidos, there was nobody his equal, nobody like him, Shari Liftoso, Bechomam and Shabaolam. It would have been legitimate to gather all the money in the world and redeem him. And if out of his great humility he didn't want, so even if he didn't want, that was very selfish of him. We should have recognized that his being in prison was causing great bittul Torah, and we should have wanted him back. And then he goes on to point out that he had a great student. Gam shamati shahaya bedas oso atzora litfos gam harush talmido, says the Maharshal. The Maharshal lives 1510 to 1573, so we're talking about a few centuries later. And the Maharshal has a tradition, and he says, I understand, and here it's why it's relevant to our story, that after the Maharami Rutenberg, who was target number 2? None other than his great esteemed student, Rabbeinu Asher the Rush. V'nodalo ubarach, and he ran to Toledo. V'nitzo barachamav uvarav chasadav, and he was saved out of Hashem's great mercy. M'shemachi amar chasad mutav shetovad ma'al chochma ha'yisaras mi'yisrov and ma'ashetov ha'chochma sa'torah ikar v'zeh ha'osh as pasko osu ha'davar v'shamad etfos chochmei ha'gola. And therefore, the Maharshal credits the Maharam that the fact that the Maharam did not acquiesce, did not give in, the Maharam suffered personally and paid the ultimate price by dying in prison. He actually saved rabbinic leadership, he saved Jewry in some sense, because by setting that precedent, though they wanted to get the Rush fled, and they realized, the authorities, King Rudolph and others, that there was no point in continuing to imprison great rabbis, because they wouldn't pay the ransom, it wouldn't help. While the Maharami Rutenberg was in prison, Rabbeinu Asher assumed Rav Meir's position, the Maharam's position in Worms. He became one of the great rabbis of the Rhineland, the Holy Roman Empire in Germany. And then, as the Maharshal just told us, our tradition is that the government was targeting the Rush next. He was blackmailed, and therefore he was forced to flee. He left Germany in 1303. He went first to southern France, Provence, Catalonia, and then to Spain. Now, when I tell you that itinerary, it sounds like a nice summer trip. You buy one flight, and then you get a ticket on the train, and you could hit all those cities. You could hit all those cities, not in a period of months. You could hit all those cities in a period of days, of hours. It's a train ride. You could probably get a great ticket, a Groupon. Get it all locked up in one shot. Southern France, Provence, Catalonia, Toledo. But then, to pack up your family, to pack up all of your possessions, to make that trip from city to city was no small feat. And Rabbeinu Asher did it and authored the Rush and gave us the Piskei Rush and gave us all the literature that we're going to talk about tonight. Where was his first stop when he got to Spain? He first migrated to southern France, to Provence, but he wasn't satisfied with the level of Frumkeit. It wasn't just that the persecution continued, and to follow him there, he wasn't satisfied with the environment religiously, and so he continued to go, he continued to descend into Spain, and his first stop was Barcelona. And where was he greeted? By somebody who actually was a contemporary, a peer, a colleague, and a friend, somebody he had exchanged responsa with, namely Reb Shlomo ben Aderes, otherwise known to us as the Rashba. The Rashba. The Rashba was a Talmud of the Ramban, and the Rashba and the Ramban, unusual for Spanish leaders, had an affinity for Ashkenazi leaders, for the leaders, for the rabbis of Ashkenaz, of France and Germany, for the Balei HaTosfos. As we'll mention in a moment, the rest of Spanish Jewry and rabbinic leadership had very little use for Ashkenazim. Not much has changed today, but had very little use for Ashkenazim, and in fact did not incorporate the learning of Tosos at all, the Rashba, as a student of the Ramban, were exceptions to that rule, and therefore there had been halachic exchange letters responsible between the Rush while he was still in Germany with the Rashba. He stops in Barcelona and he's greeted and spends time with the Rashba, Rav Shlomo ben Aderes, who then the Rashba gives him a rabbinic endorsement, very important. Some Ashkenazi Vuzvuz comes from Germany and is going to look for a rabbinic position among the Svardim. You need to have a big haskama from a Spanish rabbi, from a Svardic rabbi, and he gets from his friend and colleague, the Rashba, where he moves to Toledo and he becomes the chief dayan, the chief judge in matters of Jewish law, the chief rabbi of the community, all based on the haskama, based on the invaluable recommendation of the Rashba, which proved critically important for him. In Toledo, in Spain, where he serves, the Rush learns Arabic. Interesting, he's a judge. How could you be a judge and listen to the litigants and not speak their language? You're going to have a translator? You know what gets lost in translation? So Rabbeinu Asher, the Rush, learns Arabic. He learns spoken Arabic, but not written Arabic. I read in one of the scholarly articles that, I don't know exactly how they know that, but that he understood Arabic, and because he felt he needed to learn it in order to serve as a judge in court, but he did not read or write Arabic. Ultimately, he dies in Toledo on the 9th of Cheshvan, in the year 5088, 1327. He dies in a state of poverty, which you can imagine, having moved from place to place to place. And he's known, his known surviving children ultimately are killed in persecutions that affected Spain in 1392. So let's unpack, let's tell you more of his story. When the Rush moved, he was not a young man. I'm about to tell you his age, he was not an old man. But my point is, he wasn't 19 years old going for his year in Israel. He was 55 years old at the time that he emigrated. He packed up his family and went from place to place to place and reinvented himself and learned a new language and established himself with new authority and tried to assimilate religiously into his new surroundings. By the time he had left Germany, he had mastered the approach to Torah learning, the halachic methodologies of Germany and of France, of the Baalei HaTosfos. And here there's a fundamental difference. And the Rush plays a critical role in being a bridge between these two schools, these two methodologies, merges them in a way which is a gift. And it's hard to imagine the development and evolution of halacha until today without this contribution of the Rush. In Ashkenaz, in France and Germany, halacha was Talmud-centric. What I'm about to tell you is going to blow your mind because it's hard for us to imagine. When I say the word yeshiva, if we were to play word association, if I say yeshiva, you say Gemara. You know, everyone complains, why don't they learn Tanakh? There's a tiny little Musar Seder, maybe Maksha, a little Chassidus. You could take the most hardcore Chassidus yeshiva, Litvus yeshiva. They all have in common an emphasis, and they center on the study of Gemara. But Meir Shapiro gifted us the Daf Yomi. How many hundreds of thousands of Daf Yomi yidden around the world today? It's unbelievable, the gift of the Daf Yomi. Our life revolves around the Daf. What Daf are you on? What is the Daf that day? Gemara. Gemara, to be a Shas Yid, to be a Shas Yid has become a badge of honor in our world. To us, it's synonymous with being in yeshivas, learning Gemara, learning the Daf, completing Shas, being a Shas Yid. And that's the way it was in Ashkenaz. In France and in Germany, halacha, yeshiva, the curriculum was Talmud-centric. And that's where the Tosafos developed, because they compared, they contrasted, they did an analysis, they asked questions based on the Gemara. Any student of Gemara knows you open Gemara and you start reading Tosfos. Tosfos is Tema. How could the Gemara on this page say this? What about the Gemara on that page? It says that. And now how are we going to reconcile the Gemara on this page with the Gemara on that page and make sense of it? Oh, it must be in our analysis. Here's the common thread, or there's two different authors, or your assumption is wrong in asking the question. But the entire school of Tosfos is based on a Talmud-centric style of learning and comparing and contrasting and working it all out together. I recently met with Gedaliah Zlotowitz, the head of Art Scroll. He was in town, and we were talking about some of the changes in the world of publishing, what Art Scroll is putting out. Art Scroll is now putting out English translated and elucidated Tosfos and Shas. He started in Seder Moed, And that way the yeshiva guys are not going to cheat and go right to the art scroll Tosfos. But it's interesting, I said to him, like, who's the market? English, like, if you want to learn Tosfos, usually you know how to learn Tosfos. If you don't know how to learn, who's the market? So he said it, you know, the argument when Art Scroll first put out its translation, again, we take it for granted today. Art Scroll, what Art Scroll Gemaras have done for Torah learning, it's absolutely, absolutely extraordinary. And other translations which have come out, Koran, Rabbi Stein, Zalt, and others. What Art Scroll's done is amazing. The first volumes of Art Scroll had pages and pages and pages of endorsements of Haskamas. Why? Not because they thought it would sell better, but because there was in fact opposition. It was not unprecedented, but it was extremely controversial to make our Torah Shebaal Peh, which had to be written down but wasn't meant to make it so accessible to the masses by translating it. It was deemed incredibly, incredibly controversial. Incredibly controversial. Others thought you're going to dumb down Gemara study. I remember when I was in Shiva in Kerem Biavna, I don't know if it's still this way, the rule was the Art Scroll Gemaras, they had them, but not in the base medrash, they were in the library. If you got stuck on a Gemara, you couldn't just go to the shelf on the side of the room. You had to make it all the way to the library, you know, between Siddharam at lunch or later to check up the Art Scroll. It shouldn't be a crutch. It shouldn't be a way of not, in fact, toiling and exerting our greatest effort in learning. So he told me, it's fascinating, that with Art Scroll, the more people who have access, the more open the Gemara has come, it has not dumbed down learning, it's elevated learning. So people who've now gained access because of what Art Scroll's done, they want to learn Tosfos also. If our world, if the yeshiva world, if the world of rabbinic Judaism revolves around Gemara, then Tosfos is included in that conversation. Tosfos is a main character, a main voice in that conversation. So they're translating Tosfos. It's absolutely wild. So the Balei HaTosfos, they wrote according to the order of the Talmud, the Ravya, the Or Zarua, even though they're not printed on the page, we think of Tosfos as those on the side of the page. But we have many Balei HaTosfos. The Ravya, the Or Zarua, the Ravan, others, they're not printed, but they are printed according to the order of Shas. Now let's go on the train and go to Spain. Castile, the 14th century. Yeshivas don't study Talmud. They never heard of Tosfos. They have no use for Tosfos. The Balei HaTosfos, these offspring of Rashi and beyond, these leaders of France and Germany, Spanish Jewry says, what do they have to say for us? We don't need them. We're not interested in them. And it doesn't revolve around the Talmud. How did they study and what did they study? Two other works. Anyone guess who they were? I'll give you a hint. We mentioned the Shulchan Aruch decides based on three, and the Rush is not yet living in Spain. So who are they studying? The Rif and the Rambam. Rabbeinu Alfasi, the Rif, that is printed in the back of our Gemara, who comes to halachic conclusions after the discussion of the Gemara, and the Rambam. The Rambam, who does not go according to the order of the Gemara, the Rambam who organizes all of Halacha into his Mishnah Torah, into his Yad HaChazaka, the Rambam of Moshe ben Maimon, who lives 100 years before the Rush, the Rambam who lives in Egypt and then moves to Israel, the Rambam organizes Halacha in an encyclopedia thematically into 14 different categories, 14 different books. The Rambam, in his introduction, says the name of his book is the Mishnah Torah. Mishnah Torah means the repetition or the codification or the whole Torah. The Rambam's vision, and in fact this is what happened in Spain. The Rambam's vision was you don't need a whole library. You don't need a whole bookcase. You don't need a terabyte thumb drive. All you need are my books. Because I took the entire Talmud from beginning to end and I simplified and I consolidated. And instead of all of the debate and the back and forth, it's Mishneh Torah. This is the repetition of the consolidated version of the whole Torah. The Rambam, we said, was controversial for several reasons. His books were burnt. Some great leader said he was reincarnated as a worm. There were all kinds of terrible things that were said about the Rambam. But among the reasons he was controversial was not only are some of his philosophical positions, was his boldness in saying, Mishneh Torah. You don't need a whole library. All you've got, all you need is my 14 books. We don't call it the Mishneh Torah. We call it the Yad HaChazaka. Yad, Yud Daled, 14, they're 14 books. The Yad HaChazaka, the Rambam's 14 books. So indeed, the Jews of Spain followed the Rambam's directive. They embraced the Rambam's proposal. You can shelve the Talmud, let it gather dust, and all you need to open up is the Yad HaChazaka. All you need to do is go through the 14 books of the Rambam, his Mishneh Torah, and you have it all. And here we have a clash between Ashkenaz and Sfard, between France and Germany and Spain, between the Balei HaTosfos, the Rambam, and the Rif. Are we meant to continue to study the Talmud, analyze and debate and extract and extrapolate, compare and contrast? Or no, we come to the final conclusion, and that's what matters, the takeaway. You know, sometimes I give classes, and Rabbi, what's the bottom line? I love that question. We start with the Pasuk, and we go through the Gemara, and the Rishonim, and Reb Moshe says this way, and the Chazanish, Reb Moshe says this way, and the Chazanish says this way, and someone, Rabbi, what's the bottom line? Just give me the bottom line. Spain, they wanted the bottom line, and in France and Germany, they wanted to know how they got there. In 1310, in his Yesod Olam, a book on astronomy and the calendar, Yitzhak Yisraeli, who's a student of Rabbeinu Asher, a student of the Rush, writes, he writes, quote, "As soon as the work of the Rambam was made public and disseminated throughout the diaspora, all of Israel agreed to rule in accordance with its dictates on all matters of law, rabbinic ordinances, and custom." Before the Shulchan Aruch was embraced as the authoritative work, the Rambam was in Spain. That was it. That was all you needed. And that's what the Rush discovers, Rabbeinu Asher discovers, when he moves at 55 years old with his family to southern France, to Provence, and he stops in Barcelona and he makes his way to Toledo. In Toledo, when he arrives, 1305, he finds the local rabbis, the Dayanim, they paskin, they are familiar with, they are aware only of the Rambam. He says, "Bring me a Gemara." They say, "What's Gemara? Where Gemara? What volume of Gemara?" Again, does that blow your mind? We can't even imagine it. Yeshivas who don't have Gemara in the curriculum, Rabbanim, Dayanim, and Poskim who aren't familiar with the Gemara, they're quoting and they know the Rif and the Rambam. They care about the bottom line conclusion. No sources, no divergent opinions, no debate. That is how he got there. The Rambam himself regards the rabbis of France as inferior to those of Spain. So there is a tradition from the Rambam to Spanish Jewry to view the leaders of Ashkenaz as their scholarship as inferior. Ashkenaz, as we said, it was all organized according to the order of the Talmud. So the Rush comes from that experience in school, and he discovers this now here in Spain, and he is terribly, terribly bothered. And he's bothered for two reasons. The Rush, Rabbeinu Asher, is bothered because he thinks fundamentally the methodology is wrong. Abandoning the study of Talmud, not being Gemara-centric, not knowing from the primary source, not studying divergent opinions and coming to conclusions based on majority, fundamentally and methodologically, he thinks it's wrong. But then sociologically, he sees the level of observance or lack thereof, some of the laxity in halacha. He sees some of the assimilation. He sees some of the acculturation. And the Rabbeinu Asher, the Rush, can't help but conclude that there's a connection between the methodology and learning and the practice, the behavior, the levels or lack of levels of piety, of scrupulous observance of the community itself. There's no emphasis on Talmud study, only on what they call the Talmud Katan, the Rif, Afasi. The Rif is known as the Talmud Katan in Spain among Sfardim. Who needs the big Talmud? We have the consolidated, concise. We have, you know, some of us grew up on, my parents are here, but the Cliff Notes. The Rif is the Cliff Notes. So I would have been very happy in Spain. So in Spain they say, we really have to read the whole book? Do they have a movie? Are there Cliff Notes? The Rif is the Talmud Katan. They're very happy with, it turned out okay. I'm teaching a lecture tonight, and the people who actually showed up, it's extraordinary. My parents still don't believe it. They still don't believe it. So this is what Rabbeinu Asher discovers when he comes to Spain, and he's terribly bothered, because as I said, fundamentally he's bothered, in principle, and he's bothered because he correlates the laxity in observance and the behaviors that are bothering him, he correlates it specifically with this methodology. And so he devotes and dedicates himself to reform and change the learning in Spain. And this is an enormous contribution. He takes the culture, halachic culture of Germany, and he brings it with him down into Spain. He reforms the curriculum in yeshivas. He introduces and reintroduces the Gemara, Rashi, Tosfos. He inspires the Rabbanim and the Dayanim to not only know the Cliff Notes, to not study the art scroll halacha conclusions, but go back to the primary sources. Go study the Gemara, see the Rishonim, analyze and understand. In Castile, the Rosh edits a set of authorized Tosfos. He teaches Tosfos. He reintroduces the style of Tosfos, and he edits the Tosfos known as Tosfos HaRosh. If you've ever studied Tosfos HaRosh, it's not printed in the Gemara. Some volumes it's on the side, but printed independently. And several Masechtas, we have the Tosfos HaRosh, which it's unclear whether they represent his own Tosfos, or they're simply published, edited, and amended by him. It includes the opinions of his Rebbe. Tosfos HaRosh includes the Maharal Mirutenberg. It includes the Ramban. It includes Reb Meir Abulafia. In Tosfos HaRosh, he integrates Tosfos of France and Germany with some of the greats of Spain, where he is. In an effort to try to wean the students, the Talmidim, and the leaders from the Rif and the Rambam, the Rosh decides he's going to compose his own psukim. He composes his own halachic conclusions. He generally quotes the Rif's opinion, and then he suggests an alternative conclusion based on Tosfos. We'll sometimes try to reconcile them, and the Rosh comes to his own conclusions. And that is the gift that we have in the back of our Masechtas of the Piskei HaRosh. The Piskei HaRosh are the Rosh's analysis of the Talmud. He was trying to wean the students from going to the Shas Katan of the Rif, study the Gemara, come with me on the journey through Rashi, Tosfos, and the Spanish authorities, the Ramban and others. And then this is my conclusion, says the Rosh. The Rosh's Piskei HaRosh are in the back of Masechtas, but only halachic sugyas. The Rosh does not write on Agarata. So Masechet Tanis, those who just learned the Daf Yomi, Masechet Tanis, which is almost all overwhelmingly Agarata, the Rosh doesn't have that much to say other than the halachic portions. The Rosh concerns himself only with the halachic, the conclusions in Jewish law, not with the Agarata. He makes it very clear that unlike the Rambam, who thinks that the Spanish rabbinic leaders are superior, he thinks that they are inferior in their scholarship, and he writes that in his psukim. He's not shy to be able to mention that. Was he successful? Did he transform the attitude and the curriculum and the methodology in Spain? Well, let me read to you the words of his own son, Rabbi Yehuda, who says, quote, "It was from Hashem that the Rosh had to leave Germany in order to raise many students in the lands of Spain, for in the lands there was no accurate commentaries on the Talmud." In the 14th century, Rav Menachem ben Zerach, a student of the Rosh's son Yehuda, Rabbi Yehuda, wrote in his Seder LaDerach, he has a sefer called Seder LaDerach, and he writes, "Yadanu shalom de mabavli ve masiba rachoka vakrova, uvishnas chamesha salafim vishivim vachamisha, heir Hashem ez ruach, hagon Rabbi Asher ben Rabbi Yechiel, lotzes me'ashkanaz hu ubanov b'nei beso, lagur betoledo, v'yashav sham de hirbitz Torah beravim ve'hem itamidim harbei." God, thank God, he writes, again, Rav Menachem ben Zerach, in his book called the Tzedal L'Derach, he lived from 1319 to 1385. He is a student of the son of the Rosh, and he says, thank God that Hashem put into Rabbeinu Asher ben Yechiel's mind to migrate, to move from Ashkenaz to Toledo with his family, where he set up yeshivas. V'ayadoh hechziku lomdei abavli, v'asoh chibur apsakim al derech alfasi, v'hosef em divrei tosfos. And he reestablished the learning of Talmud. Asa chibur, he made a connection between the halachic methodology of the Rif with the Tosfos, Medeos Bali Achidushim, Rabbeinu Meir Halevi, Ramban, Rabbeinu Yonah ben Avram, and so on and so forth, writes the Rav Menachem ben Zerach. That the spirit of Hashem awakened within Rabbeinu Asher, and he came, and he was incredibly successful. The Rosh was very frustrated. He was very frustrated by this lack of methodology, and here he was successful. He writes it in his own shuvas. Let me read to you from some shuvas of the Rosh. The Rosh writes, in Shuvas HaRosh, Simon Mem Gimel, he says, quote, "Tipach Ruchan, a curse on those who decide the law on the basis of the books and codes of the great ones, without knowing anything of the Mishnah and Talmud." He was cursing his colleagues in Spain. He was cursing that culture, that curriculum. "Impossible to reach accurate or correct conclusions without examining Talmudic sources, because copyists are fallible." He was worried, all you're going to study is the Rambam and Rif. What if they made a mistake? You have to go back to the primary source. How do you know it's accurate without going back to the primary source? When I was in yeshiva, they taught us that often. Don't take anyone's word for it. Just because the Acharon quotes the Rishon that way and then analyzes it, open the Rishon, check for yourself. whenever someone writes v'chulei, three dots, and then makes assumptions or tries to simply summarize what they said, this is true, I'm sure, in secular academics and scholarship, go back to the primary source. The only way you could be a true scholar is if you're literate and familiar with the primary sources themselves and not relying on what others write. The Rosh was terribly bothered. He writes in another tshuva, Lamed Aleph, prone to error are those who decide the law in accordance with the words of the Rambam, while not knowing the Talmud, the sources. They err. They permit the prohibited and they prohibit the permissible. He was worried that not only will they be matir, that which is asr, but they'll asr, that which is mutter. They'll distort the halacha. It won't be accurate. And then Rabbeinu Asher, the Rush, the little rabbinic trash talking, talks about the Rambam. The Rambam did not do as the other authors did. They brought proofs for their decisions. They directed the reader to the Talmudic source of the decisions. They allowed the reader to comprehend the important and the true. He, the Rambam, however, wrote as though he were a prophet, without explanation, without sources. You open a Mishnah Torah, you open a Yad HaChazaka, you read a Rambam, a Lach and the Rambam. You don't know where he got it from. He doesn't tell you where the source is. He doesn't tell you how other people studied it or understood it. He writes as if this is the only way to understand it. And the Rush is very, very critical of it. All those who read his work believe they understood his intent, but it's not so. Whoever is not attentive to what's written in the Talmud cannot truly comprehend his words and will ultimately fail in deciding the law. So the Rambam, and here we have this contrast, the method of the Rif and the Rambam. Rabbeinu Asher comes from the school of Tosfos, sort of integrates the two and brings that methodology and halachic methodology down to Spain. And now go to the next generation. I told you that Rabbeinu Asher, the Rosh, had a son, Rav Yaakov. The Rosh wrote his halachic psakim. How and where do they appear? According to what order? The back of the Gemara. The back of the Gemara. The problem is that assumes that you know where everything is in the Gemara. For example, there are significant sugyas in Hilchos Nida that appear, for whatever reason, because it was a detour the Gemara took in Maseches Shavuos. And the Rosh's halachic opinions on Hilchos Nida, many of them are in Maseches Shavuos. But how would you know that? There's no index, there's no table of contents. Talmud Bavli is Mivul Baal, it's all mixed up. Rav Huttner has a whole argument why that is by design on purpose. It preserved the Torah Sheba'al Peh. It preserved the oral transmission idea. You still needed a Rebbe. The Gemara is one big mishkabab. Again, if you've ever learned Gemara, your head is spinning halfway through one page. A detour followed by a detour followed by a detour. It's hard to remember how you got started or how to get back on the highway. So if you're going to write a commentary on halachic conclusions based on this Mivul Baal, based on this mixed up and no system literature, how will anyone know where your psakim are? So that motivated his son, Rabbi Yaakov, to say, you know what? Halach has to be organized. If people are going to study it, and people are going to apply it, it has to be organized. So Rabbeinu Asher, the Rosh's son, says not according to the order of Masechtas published in the back of the Talmud, but a separate system, the four turim. A tur is a column. These are the columns that will hold up the Jewish house. So he called it the Arba Turim. Orachayim, Choshen Mishpa, Yerodea, Evin Ezer. These are the Arba Turim. And by the end of the 15th century, the Tur overtakes the Mishneh Torah as the primary legal text in Castile in Spain. That's all the Rush. Until the Rush, it's the Rif and the Rambam that's being studied. It's the only halachic authority. There is no analysis. There are no divergent opinions. But because of Rabbeinu Asher, the Rosh's influence, by the 15th century, it is his son, Rabbi Yaakov's Arba Turim. It is the Tur that is the dominant halachic text that's being studied even in Spain. And what was the methodology of the Tur? His system, his code is systematic. There's no Talmudic sources. So his father's criticism of the Rambam you could have of the Tur. The Tur doesn't quote where the Gemara is. However, he does embrace his father's methodology of giving divergent opinions. So Rabbeinu Yaakov, the Rosh's son, in his halachic system, the four turim, the four columns, comes to a compromise between his father and the Rambam. On the one hand, like the Rambam, he does not incorporate the primary text. He does not quote the Gemara. However, like his father, the Rosh, he does quote divergent opinions before coming to his halachic conclusion of what's right. By the way, the Torah writes, Rabbeinu Yaakov, ben Aram, ben Arush, Ben Rabbeinu Asher writes the Tur, the Arba Turim, the four columns. Because he doesn't tell you the primary source, two contemporaries have a race to write commentary on this tour in order to tell you what were the primary sources and how he got there. One is Rav Yoel Sirkes the Bach, and the other is Rav Yosef Karo, 16th century, known as the Beis Yosef. Known as the Beis Yosef. The Beis Yosef got there first, Rav Yosef Karo. And his name is Yosef. If he wrote the Arba Turim, the four columns, what are the four columns holding up? My house, the Beis Yosef, the house of Yosef. Rav Yoel Sirkes, who disagrees often, says, oh yeah, you wrote the house of Yosef, guess what? There's a new house in town. And he writes the Bayis Chadash, the Bach. This is how they name their books. I say, one day I want to publish a book called Rabbinic Trash Talking, between the Rambam and the Ravid, between the Ramban and the Baal HaMor, between the Bach and the Beis Yosef, all respectful and all in order to increase Torah study, but a shtickle competition. Kenesof from Tarba Chochma. So the Arba Turim, you have the four columns. The Rush is in the back of the Gemara. His son creates four categories of halacha, four columns. The four columns hold up the commentary of the Beis Yosef. Then the Bayis Chadash says there's a new house in town. He writes the Bayis Chadash, the Bach, on the Beis Yosef. The Beis Yosef says it's nice that we have a house that's held up by columns, but you know what you need inside a house? You need a set table. So he writes the Shulchan Aruch. And then Moshe Isserles, the Ramah, comes along and says, that's a nice table. You know what it needs? It needs my tablecloth. My mappa spread out on top of it. And we keep going with the names and the images of each one, one-upping, so to say, one-upping the other. Okay, so this is the Rush, why he had to flee, what he discovers, and what he changes in terms of halachic study and halachic methodology. In his religious attitude, he resembles his teacher, the Maharam Rutenberg. He takes a very strict approach. He has an aversion to lenient opinions, to kulas, but rather he rules often strictly. But he also follows the Maharam in that he's very opposed to the study of philosophy. He's opposed to the study of philosophy, of secular knowledge. And in fact, he writes that he thanks God for having saved him from its influence. And he boasts, Rabbeinu Asher boasts, that he has no secular knowledge. He has no knowledge outside of Torah. He's proud and he boasts that his whole view of the world only comes through the prism of Torah. His position is defined when he states that philosophy is based on critical research and religion is based on tradition, and therefore there is no harmony and you cannot reconcile the two. And philosophy he not only rejects, but when he comes to Spain, and here in Spain he finds a greater embrace of philosophy. We know the Mor Nevuchim of the Rambam, we know the Kuzari of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, we know some of the great philosophers that come from Spain. That's of course Jewish philosophy, but they have an awareness of secular philosophy as well. And Rabbeinu Asher, the Rush, again correlates the laxity in observance and the level of assimilation with the exposure and the embrace of philosophy and secular knowledge. He comes and he signs on to a ban that nobody under the age of 30 is allowed to study philosophy. He says they're not allowed. So what's interesting, I heard of Lopiansky describe it this way, non-Jewish historians, when they analyze Rabbeinu Asher, the Rush, they like to paint a picture that in Spain, it was the golden age of Spanish Jewry. And then a group of extremists migrated. Some fundamentalists came from Germany, and they came out against philosophy and against culture, and they tried to destroy and undermine this beautiful golden age of Spanish Jewry. But that's not an accurate and clear picture. That paints it with a bias. The truth is that there were challenges within the Spanish Jewish community, and there was an ongoing battle already. The Rambam, Rabbeinu Yonah, and others. And in fact, you could read all about it. The hour is already late, so I'm going to summarize some of this. Although there's so much richness to share here about the Rush and about what was happening in Ashkenaz and Sfarad, in Germany and in Spain. There's a book called the Minchas Kenos. The Minchas Kenos was published, a series of letters back and forth from that time, all about this debate. How much should a yeshiva curriculum, how much should religious Jews be exposed to secular philosophy and to secular culture? On the one hand, it can enrich, it can elevate. On the other hand, it can detract and distract, it could corrupt what we believe in. And so there was a series of letters called upon the Rashba to get involved, and other Spanish rabbis sent a letter proposing this ban, and many embraced it, and there was a big schism between the Jews of Spain and the Jews of France in exactly this level of exposure and integration and involvement with secular philosophy, secular culture. There was a book called Adraba that came out against this series of letters that dealt with this ban and that dealt with what was going on. Among the two extreme voices, some entirely in favor of studying philosophy and secular culture, and others enormously and extremely opposed, the Rashba and the Rush were considered in the middle. They were more moderate. On the one hand, they were opposed, they were concerned, but on the other hand, they were more moderate in their voice against it. What's interesting is that even though the Rush did sign on that ban, and even though the Rush was opposed to what was the default behavior until that point, nevertheless, he was beloved. He was embraced. He was respected widely by the Jews of Spain. He was appointed to the great synagogue in Toledo. His influence grew and grew. As I mentioned, his two daughters married Sfardim, and his decisions, his halachic rulings, became the standard in the whole of Castile and the whole of Spain. They embraced the Rush. So this is the Rush's contribution. The Rush comes, and he remains Ashkenazi centrist in his hashkafa, so to say, in his worldview. He remains Ashkenazi centered in his approach and methodology of halacha, and yet he's living that way in this foreign country in Spain. He brings some of the values of Germany, not only halachic methodology and not only hashkafic opposition to secular knowledge, but sadly, something that the Jews of Ashkenaz had to learn that the Jews of Spain had not been familiar with, which was the issue of martyrdom. The Jews of Ashkenaz, because of the Crusades, the First and Second Crusade, were well aware of the question of giving your life. We're familiar with those stories. Again, we read the Kinas on Tisha B'Av and beyond. So the Rush, Rabbeinu Asher, brought the concept of self-martyrdom to Spain, to Sfarad, and during the anti-Jewish riots in Seville in 1391, his own great-grandson, Rabbi Yaakov ben Asher II, took his own life and the life of his family rather than submit to the cross, rather than convert. And that horrific act, that he took his own life and killed his own family, elicited horror from the Sephardic community, who were unfamiliar with that type of behavior, who had not experienced that type of martyrdom. So clearly that was part of the family tradition and the tradition of Ashkenaz that he brought as well. It's interesting that though most of his career was in Germany, most of his writing takes place in Spain. So most of what molded him into who he was as a halachist took place under the German influence, the influence of Ashkenaz, but his halachic rulings took place in Spain. They were almost all of his tshuvas were written in the last 23 years of his life. And even though he's writing in Spain, he's still quoting the Ashkenazi Gedolim and not the Spanish Gedolim. However, he does fuse these halachas. And again, if we had more time, there are many, many examples. When the Torah quotes, should you wear tefillin on Chol HaMoed? He talks about the fact that his father wore tefillin. It's the custom, the Ashkenazi custom. The Sfardi, those who are Hasidish and Nusach Sfard, also follow to not wear tefillin. And the Torah quotes, Adoni Avi HaRosh. He very often quotes, Adoni Avi HaRosh did this. He quotes the divergent opinions and comes to a halachic conclusion. The Rush tried to bring that practice to Spain as well. One practice he was successful in bringing was kitnios. Kitnios is an Ashkenazi innovation. Sfardim never observed kitnios. Kitnios was introduced by the Rishonim, by the Smag, the Smak, and they were concerned with two things, kitnios. Kitnios, legumes on Pesach. One concern was that anything that can be ground into flour and manipulated like one of the five grains, if we allow you to eat that, you might come to eat actual chametz. Ha! Today we have kosher Pesach bagels, kosher Pesach pizza, kosher Pesach. The spirit of kitnios is certainly being violated left and right today. That was one reason. The other reason was that these legumes and beans were stored and sold in sacks that the proprietor often used flour, wheat, in order to bolster and to bulk up the sack. So there was concern that there was actual chametz mixed in. So whichever the reason, Ashkenazi Jewry embraced the custom of a prohibition of kitnios, but the Sfardim never worried about it. However, the Rush brought the practice of kitnios to Spain, and as a result, any Moroccans here? Moroccans have the worst of both worlds. They have to get up early every day of Elul, and they don't eat kitnios. Though we always think that Sephardim do eat kitnios, Moroccans, at least many Moroccans, do not eat kitnios, and that is part of the legacy, the contribution of the tradition that Rabbeinu Asher, that the Rosh brought to, that he brought to Spain. The Rosh is so significant that the Maharal, Rabbi Yehuda Lowy of Prague, actually suggests at one point that the Rosh should be printed on the side of the Gemara. Not instead of Tosos necessarily, but that the Rosh is such a halachic, a critical halachic voice, that it should be printed on the side of the Gemara as well. I wanted to study, but I'll just leave it to you to look at. What you have here on the handout is one example where the Rosh himself writes about his experience in Germany and then his experience in Spain. We could take a look at it. I could read it to you in the translation a little bit. But he writes it was the year 5073. Vayihi Bishnas Chameshes Alafim V'Shivim V'Shalosh L'Brias Olam. It's on the page that says 14, on the right-hand column. You see it? It was in the year 5073. Netzer Hageshamim V'lohimtir Kol HaChoref Ela Ma'at Mezir V'yikru Tzom L'Schanin L'Hashem L'Aseis Matar Al Pnei Adama. It was the year 5073, or otherwise the year 1313. And it rained very little the entire winter. And the community declared a fast. Again, those learning the daf are familiar from Maseches Tanis that we just concluded. So what happens? Vayi b'lal rishon shel Pesach, acharei tefilas arvis. And here it is, the first night of Pesach. And we finished davening Maariv. V'adoni avi arash haya yoshev al Pesach beso. And it's good to know that even then, the men lingered at shul after davening. Their wives undoubtedly complained. And the chevra was hanging out on his right, on his left. We were all hanging out with the Rosh. The year 1313, after Marav, the first night of Pesach, we weren't ready to start the Seder yet. And the Rosh says, now is the time to raise a matter that's always bothered me. Why don't we continue saying the Saint Talmud Matar until Shavuos? Why did that bother the Rosh? So he told the Rosh, why don't you tell that to the elders? They thought that's a good idea. Why? So again, we don't have time, but the Gemara says, when should we make the switch to the Saint Talmud Matar? In Israel is a debate, the 7th of Cheshvan, the 5th of Cheshvan, and the Gemara says, outside of Israel, 60 days after the equinox, in Bavel, 60 days after the equinox, which comes out to be December 4th. Again, discussion, what's an equinox, why 60 days, but the rainy season in Bavel correlates with the rainy season in Bavel. So there was always a halachic discussion that said, but what if I'm not living in Bavel? Why am I praying for rain based on the rainy season of Babylonia? I understand if Jews center our lives around Israel, even then, pray for the rain for the rainy season in Israel. What happens if you're living south of the equator? What happens if you're living in an area where the seasons are reversed? You're going to pray for the rain in the summer? And then in the rainy season in the winter, you're going to be saying the same bracha? How does that make sense? So Spain is a southern country, and the Rosh is bothered that our core rainy season, he learns when he gets to Spain, is from Pesach to Shavuos. So why are we stopping to say V'sein Ta'alu Matar on Pesach? Keep it going till Shavuos. And that's what they tell the Chazan. Tomorrow, mention Geshem. What happens? The board gets together, the ritual committee says, nobody asked us. We didn't vote on this. Who instituted this? Who said this? And a whole discussion, a whole debate comes out. And the Rosh says, skip to the underline. Mikfar yamim rabim ma'ashkenaz. Nisra'amti ashnei dvarm shereisa shenoigim biyamim mahalalu. Says the Rosh, ever since I was back in Germany, I've had two concerns, two complaints. And this is one of them. And he goes on and he talks about the other one of them. And this is an example. And it's worth reading this entire tshuva here of the Rosh, where he talks about perhaps continuing to say it. He pens this very lengthy tshuva, and he advocates for his position, and he claims that this is the position of the Rambam, in fact, as well. And the halachic analysis continues until today. I'm happy to send the source sheet to anyone who wants them. Poskim in our day are dealing with that. If you live in Australia, when do you say V'seinta Alamatar? Should you reverse it in your Baruch Aleinu? Do you stick it into Shema Koleinu? And the key source in this analysis is the Rush. And why is he the key source? Because he goes from Germany to Spain, and he brings with him that experience, and he has this discussion, he has this halachic analysis. He dies in 1327. His son Rabbi Yehuda succeeds him as the Rav of Toledo. And I'll tell you something amazing. There's a book called Emek HaBracha written in 1491. 1491, it's written later, but it recalls that in 1491, someone had a dream. And in their dream, they said, someone in Spain, we need to destroy all the matzevas, including Rabbeinu Yonah and Rabbeinu Asher the Rush, because the Jews are soon going to be expelled, and the non-Jews are going to destroy and violate, and in order to preserve and protect, we ourselves need to destroy the matzevas. And so the Sefer Emek HaBracha records that the matzeva of the Rush, Rabbeinu Yonah, were destroyed. We don't have his matzeva, but we have something even greater. We have his Torah. We have the legacy of his Torah, of his contributions, the Piskei HaRush in the back of the Gemara, and much more. Rabbeinu Asher and his two sons all wrote savos, they wrote ethical wills. And they have very interesting emphases in their ethical wills. They emphasize chibur ha-mitzvah, devotion to doing mitzvos. Why did they write that? Why do you think Rabbeinu Asher specifically called upon his progeny, his offspring, his children, I want you to be passionately devoted to the observance of mitzvos? Obviously, it was a value that he held dear, but also because of what he saw, what he had back in Germany, what he was concerned about in Spain. So that's why he tells his children. Interestingly, Rabbeinu Asher, the Rush, in his Tzava, admonishes his children to study Tanakh with Diktuk. I'm glad I wasn't one of his children. Tanakh with Diktuk, the Diktuk part, which he said it was neglected in Germany. He discovered it was being studied in Spain, and it's correct. So some things even in Spain he's holding on to from Germany, and some things he comes to Spain and says they get it right here. Studying Tanakh and Diktuk is one of them. He also endorses in his Tzava studying Rabbeinu Bachya's Chovas HaLevavos and Rabbeinu Yonah's what he calls Igeres HaTshuva, what I imagine is our Sharei Tshuva of Rabbeinu Yonah. Of Rabbeinu Yonah. The Piskei HaRush, the Turim, are studied in Germany in the 14th century. We see that there is a Now, not only in the 15th century in Spain did the Tur take over the Rambam, but in the 14th century in Germany, the Piskei HaRush have made their way back. Meaning, the Jews of Germany don't see the Rush as a defector geographically and a defector methodologically. The Piskei HaRush are being studied by the Jews of Germany in the 14th century. I'll conclude by sharing with you his literary contributions, his scholarship. What do we have from the Rush? He wrote, of course, we said on the back of the Talmud, his Piskei HaRush. He wrote a commentary on Zroim, with the exception of Brachos, commentary on Taharos. He wrote his Tosos HaRush. We have the Tshuvas, the response of the Rush. He wrote a commentary on Torah, which uses mystical interpretations in Gematria, similar to Rabbi Yaakov Ben Asher's commentary. There's a forgery. Has anyone ever heard of the Besamim Rush? The Besamim Rush is falsely attributed to the Rosh. It's a series of responses of halachic analysis, but it's actually a forgery from the 18th century, from Maskilim, and he did not, in fact, author it, even though whoever counterfeit used his name. And lastly, he wrote a book, which I studied back in yeshiva. I looked today, I haven't looked at it in years. I have all underlined and highlighted it. He wrote a book called Orchos Chaim of the Rush, which are essays on ethics, and he wrote it for his sons, and he sets down very simple messages for how a Jew should live. Basically, here's what you should think about. Here's how you should behave. Here's what matters in life. Little by little, here's how to live. It's a diary of Jewish life, of principles of Jewish life and living that he wrote for his sons. And over many centuries, it's been cherished, the Orchos Chaim L'Rush. And it's small, but it is a beautiful, beautiful map towards living a righteous and a pious life. Tosfos Yontif, my version has a commentary of the Tosfos Yontif on the Orchos Chaim L'Rush. Rav Simcha Zissel, the altar of Kelm, has a commentary. It talked about the importance, the centrality of it. And Or Yecheskel has a commentary on it. It's a wonderful work. I believe Artscroll translated it. Does anyone know if I'm right? You don't know, you should go get it. It's really worthwhile. It is excellent. Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky studied it and endorsed it and thought it was excellent as well. So this is the legacy in the life of Rabbeinu Asher of the Rush, who has to immigrate under the threat of persecution after having seen what happened to his own Rebbe, the Maharam of Rutenberg. He brings the tradition of Germany, of the Balei HaTosfos, to Spain. He succeeds in transforming and reintroducing the study of Talmud to the scholarship of Spain, which is an enormous, invaluable contribution. He also tightens the levels of observance and piety of Spain while drawing the best of what Spain has to offer as well. He serves as his bridge between the two communities. He leaves us this great legacy, and I thank you for coming this evening. Have a fantastic night.